Okay. I'm Brenda Christensen. I'm 63 years old. It's now April 7, 2013. We're here in the San Francisco StoryCorps kiosk, and I'm here with my friend, Bill Sorage, to interview him about his life as a metal artist and craftsman.
My name is Bill Sorage. I'm age 65. It's the 7th of April, 2013, and we're in the StoryCorps booth. And my friend that's interviewing me is Brenda Christensen.
So, Bill, I've always described you as both a metal artist and a metal craftsman. And would you say that that's a good description of what you do, and that they're really two different skill sets that you need to have to be both a craftsman and an artist?
Actually, I think that it's both. The craftsmanship, you know, good craftsmen, you know, approach and get to the art stage of doing things, and anybody that, you know, has built a house or had a good car knows that there's a difference between good craftsmanship and poor by what you see and how close the boards fit and how good the door closes on the car, and that's not considered art. But if you're working on those things, you, as an apprentice, and you're working with a journeyman or master, then you know it's very hard to do that. And so I think industrial art is art. The only difference between, you know, fine art is that you're taking this ball and running with it and doing your own thing with it. Whatever that piece of art is because you're a good craftsperson and you can put it together and make it look good and express what you want the art to say.
Well, you're really talking about the art and the function of quality. And quality can be a lot of things to a lot of people. And what is quality of art? You know, when you have something that's better than quality, something that's well made. What is something that's well made? What are the attributes in the world of metal?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on what we're working on. But, for example, if I was doing one of my pelicans or owls, the rendering of the parts and pieces of this thing, how well they were put together and how they were put together, and whether you were trying to disguise how they were putting together or when you wanted to show how they were put together, and, you know, the viewing distance of this piece, of what were you going to see from the distance you're looking at it from, that's important. Sometimes you can be rough, and that's okay. Like if you go to Barcelona and see Gaudi's work, a lot of it's pretty rough. But you, unless you're very, very curious, you never get within 25 feet of it. Mm-hmm. So it reads well at 25 feet. And, you know, some people go overboard. Some people don't go far enough as far as finishing the piece. But it all depends on what you're shooting for. You know, sometimes you leave it rough. You want to show the marks on the piece that it's hand-hammered. If you make it look too smooth, it looks like a machine stamped it out, and it doesn't say somebody that actually beat this thing out of a flat piece of plate over a, you know, into a sandbag and then, you know, put it together.
When did you first think about something being well made? Were you a child? Were there somebody in your life, another teacher or a mentor, that you knew the difference between just something put together and something being well made? When did you know that there was a distinction?
I think, you know, when I was about 5 years old, I got, you know, my dad had a drum business and industrial made machines, and the conversations around the breakfast table were always about the good workers that made good stuff, and the hackers that, you know, that basically didn't care what they did. So it started out with kind of an industrial, you know, quality thing. And then, you know, as I grew up a little more, I kind of wanted to be an artist very early in life, but knowing that, you know, artists starve to death most of the time, so that you had to do something, you know, practical, otherwise you weren't going to make it. And so the better craftsman you were meant that you had a job, because they said, we want Bill. So the hard, you know, the better quality work always was the last guy to get laid off.
So yeah. Do you think when you at that distinction, you knew that, or like you say, around the breakfast table, that there were things that your parents or your father discussed that said, this is well made, this isn't, this is somebody who's paying attention. So when you first started your first project, did you keep that in mind, or were you just busy as a child? I assume, when was your first project, and what did you know about being well made at that point?
Well, first off, you had to learn your trade well enough to be able to make something. So I kind of concentrated on doing, I went to the College of San Mateo, and before then I was, you know, high school was a kind of a zip, because I was a tradesman, but the counselors kept saying that you had to be a business administrator or something, and that people who work with their hands were, you know, second-class citizens, and it's worse now, you know, because they don't even have any of these shop classes or anything, because they're afraid they'll get sued. But in the 60s, let me see, I graduated in 66, so about 62 I was in eighth grade, and I was a little dyslexic, so they couldn't tell that. And then fortunately, I got into the College of San Mateo and went to this welding technology program run by Louis Stefratis, and he was an excellence guy. You know, he wanted to create very, very high-quality workers. And so the program was rigorous, 12-hour-a-week lab, 4 days a week, and he kind of made you a very good welder, and then gave you kind of junior engineering skills, so that at the time industry was getting more technical in weldments, and they needed people to record data that was going on as you were making them. And then they couldn't afford to have a welding engineer there all the time, and so that we kind of fit into this gap where we had enough technical skills to
So you went out as students?
No, we didn't go out as students, but we got tours. But that's what they were shooting for, was to make us the go-between between the welding engineer and the welder. We knew how to weld well, so they couldn't fool us that the weld was good when it was bad.
Uh-huh.
You know, which is a problem today even more, where that they, you know, they have people inspecting things and they don't know how to do it. So we knew how to weld very well, and then we took the data down, and I got a job at Westinghouse in Sunnyvale, and we built nuclear reactor parts and pieces for this fast flux test facility in Richland, Washington, which was the breeder reactor that made plutonium. And now it's leaking like mad. It's a big problem, and it's sodium cooled, and sodium blows up in the air. So they had to have this thing under a complete vacuum, purged with argon, and then it was a liquid metal. It was a metal until it was 600 degrees, and it turned to liquid. And it was 11-foot deep bath of this stuff. And if air got on it, it blew up and burned. I mean, this is how.
Did you get classes in welding at Westinghouse? Did they teach you special materials that you had to work with?
Oh, absolutely. I worked in the weld lab, and We had a pretty rigorous training at College of San Mateo. We were very well prepared.
Even in exotic materials and that.
Yeah, we got our little licks in on that. And, you know, the guy was, you know, he, DeFreitas was, you know, incredible guy where he got grants from industry and they gave him the material for all our test plates and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, in fact, the program was going to go broke a couple times and he wrote his students and said, well, I need $400 a piece from all you guys. And everybody sent the dough. So it was the guy was really a well-liked guy.
So did you didn't work for your father then when you were younger. So you never
no.
learned welding from him
no.
and his
they
business.
Never had time because everybody was in such a hurry that nobody had time to do it.
So you never got to sit at the knee of someone who was a good, you know, a good craftsman
no.
or anything else
no.
in your father's business?
Never struck an arc until I was in College of San Mateo.
Did your father, was he pleased that you were going to into that to understand it as a skill?
Yeah, he was. He was pleased. And I mean, I wanted to be independent. I didn't want to work for other people. And that was kind of, you know, one of those other five-year-old recollections of why, you know, what was a good trade. Maybe I didn't have it at five. Maybe I had it at about 13 or something
mm-hmm.
of where I was looking and seeing these welders that were little guy shops and they had a whole bunch of junk around the place. It wasn't junk to them. It was really parts and pieces of things they were going to use. And they always had a job and they could do it on their own. Where if you're a machinist, the machines cost so much money that mm-hmm. you've got, you know, $1 million in equipment. With a welder, you could have, you know, a welding generator and a truck and drill press and a saw, and, you know, you're basically in business. And it's mostly, you know, being clever to get the job done and hustling, you know, to, you know, work hard at it. You could go mobile or work in the shop. So it'd give you a lot of versatility. Until this very day, you know, I do some of that still. And, you know, it's fun to, you know, be in control of your situation and then figure out how to do it, and, mm-hmm. you know, and do it.
What makes a good weld? When did you know that you could really do it well? Because you had to go through all, I'm assuming there's some trial and error. And when did you know? And what did it feel like? And what does it look like today to have a good weld?
Well, what it means is when it, in College of San Mateo was we had a board with all the good welds on them, and so
as a display,
and then if we went through each weld for a week or so, and then after that time we had a test, and if there was welds that were good enough, you bump the old welds off the board and you got your weld on the board.
So it was your fame. It was, and then you got to know. Did you get some in there?
Yeah, I got two welds on the board. And so about 17 years later, I'm having lunch with my friend from Westinghouse, who was one of my classmates, and he'd still work there. And this new kid came in and he says, yeah, Bill, I bumped your weld off the board 17 years later. So it held up pretty good. It was a lot of fun. It was one of the realizations that, you know, you're getting old when 17 years goes by. But on the other hand,
it held for 17 years.
It held for 17 years. So I was proud of that.
Can I ask why metal work? Is there a moment where you...
Because my dad's business, he reconditioned steel drums. And, you know, it's kind of like a belching stack industries, you know, with, you know, a cacophony of noise, you know, that it was deafening and fire and, you know, just...
All those pyrotechnic things that young boys like.
Yeah, making stuff. And one time we got to go to Bethlehem Steel in South City. That's where my dad's drum plant was. And he knew the superintendent of Bethlehem Steel, so we got to go. And I was about five. I was really young, and we got to see the open hearth furnaces, and they were packing insulation with these big shovels, like on an oarlock,
yeah.
on a boat, and the guy would, you know, get a shovel and put it on there and shove it in the furnace, and then pat it on the walls to keep the insulation tight, and then we were given these blue didenium glasses, you know,
for protection.
Yeah, so you could look at this fire, 3,000-degree molten metal in there, you know, it's like,
And that was better than anything you could have done in wood or,
no,
I mean,
I
not
think
just
that
to be just of the powerful image for
I
you.
I knew I was
going
to be a hot metal man.
Did you?
Well,
you knew it when you saw that.
Well, I, you know, liked it.
Yeah.
I like fire.
Yeah. Did you try to do anything with wood? Plastics was too new at those times. Did you try to do anything
with
wood?
Well, you know, we were, you know, as kids, we wanted our little doodle bugs and go-karts and cars. And, you know, usually you could get, you know, a bunch of junk and then cut off something from one and cut off some from the other and then weld it together and it'd actually work. So, I mean, it was a
real... So who did the welding then? Did you try to do it yourself or did you have somebody do it?
Yeah, but, I mean, by the time that I went to College of Sam.
Oh, by that time you did.
We didn't weld, but we got somebody to weld.
Oh, you did?
Us. Yeah, we were doing it when we were like 12 years old.
So you knew what you wanted, and then you found somebody who could do
right.
the weld to make
so
sure that the wheels
So without
stay
welding,
together.
You were like bolting, you know, and bolting was nowhere. And then metal was, you know, the thing of 20th century. Wood was, you know, great, except, you know, it you couldn't make a car out of wood. You know, it was...
Yeah.
The strength of steel, you know, the span of a truss on a building or, you know, it's just mega wood. You know, wood's got its place and it's wonderful, but, you know, modern society was built on steel.
That's right. But then plastics weren't like they are now, where you have all these big robots and that. So plastics were just coming to be,
right.
I think, during the time that you're emerging. Did you ever see yourself as a tool and die man or anything like that with forms?
No, I wasn't that good because I didn't like – machining was too precise, and I was just a little dyslexic, so I couldn't handle the mathematics. Yeah, I didn't feel comfortable with it. You know, welding is more of a – sight deal where you're looking at it and you know if you get it with a 16th of an inch that's pretty close for welding so it wasn't so much you know precision
motor
to thousands
yeah.
of an inch and turning dials on machines it was more like you actually fit this together by hand and then it was you know and welding is like you weld on something and it basically warps the hell out of it so in case unless you skip around when you're welding something together, it turns into a giant pretzel, and it's worthless. So, you know, it's not so rigid as, you know, that metal is more like rubber when you weld it together, and it moves around. So you have to be very, very clever about how you weld it together so when you get it done, it isn't warped and worthless. And by holding it down with clamps and... So that it can't warp.
And can't structurally change.
Right.
So you were working at Westinghouse. It was easy. Was it easy to get the jobs when you finished the College of San Mateo, or was it a tough time then?
Well, you know, it was pretty easy because my friend was like a shoe-in. He just walked right in the door. But I had left the country and tried to get, you know, as far away from the United States as possible to avoid the Vietnam War. And then I kind of squared that thing away. And when I got back, you know, I went to Mexico and saw how poverty-stricken the country was and how there was, you know, no opportunity there. And, you know, grew up a little bit and came back to the United States and was like, yeah, this is the place, you know. This is the land of opportunity. So I talked to my friend and was beating the bush a little bit, and he said they were hiring for this new nuclear job to build this reactor components. So I went down and took the weld test and passed it, and they made land steam turbines, you know, like 40-foot high, giant metal things with rotating generators in them, and you know, it was a great plant. It's like 65-acre plant. It was like a city.
Yeah.
And I'd been there since, it was Hendy Ironworks from I think about 1850 until the end of World War II, and then Westinghouse bought the property, and Hendy made the EC-2 reciprocating steam engine for the Liberty ships. They made over 250 of these things during World War II. And so, it's, you know, the plant has been going like that. And now it's Northrop Aviation. Westinghouse kind of blew it and made a contract for uranium at a fixed price. And, of course, everybody knows the price of things go up, and they basically went out of business.
Mm-hmm. So, but you've got this wonderful world of big things and all stuff that still, like, even as an adult man, appealed to you.
I was a PhD in welding because we worked with the best engineers in the world, and we were kind of plowing new ground. And I, when I went in there, I went into the weld lab, and I did all the tests for the reactor, and they have to have a proof. You know, do a plate with the number of beads in the plate and the treat, you know, the X-ray it and heat treating it and whatever they're ultrasonic testing. And then that became the way we built the part.
Okay. You made the quality control as
exactly.
such, and then you tested against that.
And there must have been 25 of those. And then this was during Vietnam War. And then it came layoff time because the big contract was done. And so they started laying people off. And my number came up, but I was saved by this clause of 2% of the employees could be kept under, you know, military necessity.
Uh-huh.
So
sure.
this was a
Which
defense.
Happened in World War II also.
Yeah, defense plant. And so I rode on that. But I made sure I didn't walk under anybody, you know, that was above me, so they'd drop a brick on my head.
So as you were working now at Westinghouse with all this exotic materials and that stuff, were you doing your own craftsman work at home, or when did you start becoming an artist?
Well, you know,
with metals.
Tried to be practical. So, you know, it was like first things first, and the first thing is you got to have a place to do it. So I was in my dad's garage for a while, his horse barn, and then I realized that, you know, land was the whole, if you're going to have a lot of junk and equipment around, I mean, it's junk to other people, but it's all, you know.
Treasures to you.
Yeah, well, it's like money laying there, you know, pieces of metal is money that you don't have to spend, and so that you could give it to your client, and you get the job because you're, you know, supplying something that would cost more money, or a lot of money.
Yeah.
So the whole mission was is to get property and build a house on it. And then, you know, once you've got that, then you've got the leisure time that you could invest in artwork.
So where did you pick up these? You got the land then, where you live now.
Yeah. I bought the land when I was working for Westinghouse. My mom saw this ad in the paper. And being from the Woodside area, it was like, you know, going to the Santa Cruz Mountains, and we found a great piece of property that was, you know, at foreclosure, and the guy was basically kind of a gangster guy, you know. He was more of a, you know, he was on LSD, you know, chasing the guy with a butterfly net more than anything.
So this was a place for you to keep those little treasures you found, big and small.
And it was basically the Badlands. And nobody else wanted the property. It was, and at that time, you know, the hippies were going to Mendocino, and there was a lot of land up there that wasn't, there was no power.
Yeah.
And so the normal people couldn't bear to live without power, so the land was relatively cheap. And so our property was off the grid, and they wanted $250,000 to bring the power in. And nobody had any, you know, two dimes to rub together, let alone pay for that. So, and the road system was really poorly maintained because it was private. And so those two things made it so that all the people that would have bought the land didn't.
Uh-huh.
And it allowed me to get the property and other people in the same community.
So you started to, what kind of metal did you look for, and where did you find these pieces, these things that would become your inventory?
Oh, well, my dad's business closed, and everything that was metal and rolled and had gears and what have you was mine for the taking, because he would have scrapped it and got a few bucks, but it was like, you know, it was money that was stock.
It was your inventory, your stock, I guess that's the right word, stock.
So I trucked that up there and dumped it off, and started using it right away. In fact, the last couple of months, I've used a lot of stuff that I've had around for 35 years, and it's great to use it up, you know, rather than, you know, you protected it from, you know, the weather, you know, if it's not out in the rain, and then you finally get to use it, which is like, yay, you know.
It's a your treasure. So when did you move? Well, then after you left Westinghouse, or Westinghouse closed doing that, then when did you go on your own? Did you work for somebody else? What did you do as a craftsman?
So it was about 76, and I quit. And then my dad and my uncle helped me build the house for 3 months. I had basically welded all the beams together for the house, and a lot of them had beam splices in them so that they were, you know, that's one thing about metal. You can't put two pieces of wood together, mm-hmm. but with metal you can weld them together. So I prefabbed all the beams of the house, trucked them up there. We'd gotten a lot of wood because my dad knew a contractor, Schwinnerton Wahlberg Associates, which was a construction company. They did big high-rises, and they had form plywood and wood that was left over from jobs that they might have had a split in the board, and we sawed off the split side and made a 2x6 or 2x4 out of a 2x8 or a 2x12. And so we had stockpiled some of that. So we had all the 2x4s and beams for the house, and then we built the house in 3 months. And it was like roughed in, you know, no power, no wiring, no plumbing.
But you could sleep there.
Yeah. And it had fireplace.
Okay.
So then slowly, and I had a little teardrop trailer that I rolled around the garage floor. And so that kind of got me, you know, closed in. And but there's no telephone. Okay. And the road's really bad. So that took a few years. Finally, one of the ladies there expedited the telephone and got the PUC all excited and made Pac Bell run the telephone lines in at no cost. So that telephones are huge, you know, as everybody's got a cell phone now every minute of the day.
But if you're going to have your own business or anything like that, you have to have the telephone.
If somebody wanted to come up and get a little work done and then they didn't show, then you're waiting there and nothing happens. And then if you go down to call, it's 4 hours by the time you get back. And, you know, high speed, you know, modern 20th century, late 20th century was everybody's in a hurry.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was really difficult to get jobs to communicate until we got the phone. The phone was like the key.
And then you started to do your own work.
Then finally, you know, I had the time, the leisure time that I could invest in something that wasn't going to make any money because it wasn't going to sell, or, you know, it might sell.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the pieces will sit there for 10 years. And, you know, it's like you get paid the day that you sell the thing.
But you knew all along, even when you're at Westinghouse, that you had this art. You had these ideas for art in your mind. You knew it.
Absolutely.
And what were you going to do? Follow the Gaudi model of nature? Or what did you want to do as an artist?
You just kind of play it by ear, and then whatever comes up. I picked out birds as my thing, you know, because they're freedom and, you know, they can fly away. And the mountain that I lived on had a lot of raptors in it, and it would fly down the hill chasing something. You'd see a big old hawk go down the hill, just like almost straight down because the property's so steep. And, you know, see a big old explosion of feathers where they hit the pigeon or whatever they were after, and coyotes. And
so you knew you wanted to reproduce that in art, that experience or that image. Is that what you did? Is that what you wanted to do?
What I chose, you know, nature, the gates that I did were, you know, had trees and flowers and scenes of, you know, animals flying or deer, or, you know, naturalistic things. I didn't really like the curlicue traditional wrought iron. That didn't really interest me. It was more sculptural things. You know, I wanted to be a sculptor more than I wanted to be a metal artist.
Ah, okay.
But, you know, I mean, I wanted to be a metal artist in sculpture.
In sculpture.
Right, rather than blacksmith doing wrought iron railings, you know. But, of course, the money is where, you know, what happened is when we were kids, our parents went through the Great Depression, so they were frugal. They could have $1 million in the bank and they wouldn't spend it because they were afraid another depression was around the corner. And
yeah.
they were basically right. But the Silicon Valley thing came up, and then people, you know, made a lot of money, and they wanted nice things, and that included fancy wrought iron. So that was...
So you did that for a while as a blacksmith.
Yeah. So that's what I... The fabrication skills were right in line with blacksmithing, and you had to have a few different tools, like a forging hammer that was a big... air hammer that weighed 88 pounds on the ram that would hit the metal. So instead of you're beating this thing on an anvil wearing your arm out, you have a machine that does the thing. You're holding the piece, running it through, but you're not, the power of the machine is doing the forging of the metal when it's hot.
Versus the stereotype of the anvil and the hammer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And those tools had to be acquired and the skills to run those things, which was another whole. But it wasn't beyond being able to learn, because it was an outgrowth of fabrication. You know, the same tools, little different. You were doing different things to the metal. Okay. You were still bending it, forging it, and welding it together. Now, traditional blacksmithing stuff is, you know, like mortise and tenon and bolting.
Yep.
Or riveting stuff together, and welding speeds that up, because instead of, you know, having to drill and...
Oh, so you could combine those worlds then.
Right. And my art and fabrication and wrought iron was, instead of just purist stuff where it was done like it was 100 years ago, I used the TIG welder and the MIG welder and modern ways to do things so that you could... keep the price down so you could get the job. You know, it's all about the bottom line is money.
Yeah.
You know, and it was
people
just like,
people are willing to pay for that.
Right. And it's the same thing with artwork. If you get too pricey, well, it's not really a matter of money. It's a matter of how good it is. You know, people will pay, you know, one of my galleries that said, it's never about money. It's whether the guy likes it or not.
Huh.
If they like it, they'll pay for it. You know, I mean, to a point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got to be, if you're in a $2,000 gallery, then you have to have a $2,000 piece. If you're in a $1 million gallery, you can have a $1 million piece. So you got to be within the realm of where you are in this whole ball game. But it's got to be good. If it's good, it'll sell. You know, and if you've got the talk, you know, if you know what people want, and you can do it, it'll happen.
So how do you find out what people want? Just by trying?
I haven't.
Oh, okay. What materials do you work in sculpture? What materials do you work in?
I work in steel, brass, bronze, stainless steel, because that I worked in industry that welding stainless steel gives color to the piece. Mm. So, you know, if you're going to try and make a bird and you want, you know, to accent something, you use the copper or bronze and stainless to give it the color that you want, rather than, you know, like rusted metal is just fades out.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on what you're doing, and I would use that, and my industrial skills help me on that end of the thing.
Do you have a favorite material to work in more than others?
Well, I like the bronze is nice because it works easy, but stainless is great because it's just proof. It'll be there 1,000 years later, and they'll find it laying, you know, in the dirt there, and it'll take it out there. You dig it out, and it'll be there. You know, it won't rust away. Ironwork, actually, even though people think it's very durable, you know, goes away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't paint it and... if it's by the ocean in, you know, a couple of generations, it's rotted away.
What would you like people to say about when they see some of your art pieces? What would you like them to say about it?
Well, I want to create humor. You know, it's like people laughing. You know, like it's children's art for adults, too. You know, if you see my bird and it makes you laugh or smile, I think that's I've succeeded. And I don't think it ends... you know, when you're 14 or 15 years old, when you're still a kid, you know, it just starts there.
At the humor, the ability to look at something and have an emotional experience
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
So is there something you're looking out to that you'd like to design? Is there something besides you've got nature, and now is there something in nature that you haven't created that you would like to have done?
Mm-hmm. Everything. You know, no. I mean, they just come up every week. And then
something comes to you.
Yeah. And then, well, like last week, we were hiking and we saw the footprints of the cougar, coyote, and the turkey in a mud puddle. So this last week, we went, you know, in fact, yesterday we went to the blacksmithing conference. And so I did a footprints in the mud puddle. And I took a piece of, it was an old solar panel, hot water solar panel, and I, you know, had the pipes, was like explosion bonded, where they take two sheets and then they use explosives to bond them together, and then they blow out where the pipes are, so they don't have to have pipes running. They do it out of two pieces of metal that they actually bond and then blow up into a form to create the pipes. So I hammered those pipes out of the thing, and then I pounded footprints, deer prints, and the cougar prints into the copper, so it was like brownish, like a mud puddle. And then I mounted it in a frame of hammered, textured 1-inch bar, so it looked like.
So from hiking experience, you brought that back into your art.
Branches. It looked like branches that were put together. You know, like they would be lashed together with this piece of fabric on it, or, you know, a deer hide with the prints on it.
That was fun for you to do.
Yeah, it was fun, and I got good response.
Yeah?
Yeah, they liked it at the blacksmithing conference. I got a lot of compliments.
And what do you think that was so different? What does it that brought up their enjoyment of it?
Well, just that it was just, you know, footprints in a mud puddle. You know, uh-huh, what I mean? We're
all not something more traditional thing. It was something that had...
There wasn't anything like it there, you know, and a lot of all of my colleagues, they're all different. It was a great show where everybody had something different. Nobody was copying anybody else. So that was nice. And the thing about metal is, you know, you can form it, and it's got that color in it, and you can do almost anything with it, you know. Where wood, you know, if you get it too thin, it's no good. Mm-hmm. Metal really has versatility. And that's what I like about it. And I used all recycled stuff to do it. Somebody gave me the 1-inch bar, and I got the copper panel. Another guy gave me
the ultimate in recycling.
Yeah, it was like using some stock, just seeing something there and go, I'm going to make that. And Lisa said, well, that's a good idea. Why don't you do that? You know, and the modern tools allowed me to do it. Instead of beating on this thing for months, I had it done in 2 days.
And right, something that you
because
could
I
enjoy.
Used an air hammer and you use a sandbag. It's the same technique as that, you know, Michelangelo used, except that I had air pressure doing it and it all got done. And
so now this means as you have decades ahead that you can still continue to do this artwork.
Hopefully.
Without because you haven't had to beat up your body so much to do it. If you're a blacksmith, it would probably be a little bit more difficult.
It's pretty beat up, but I think there's a few miles left in it.
Well, one of the reasons Tom and I wanted to have this interview with you is that, and I'm not going to say a direct quote because I don't have it written down, but there was this wonderful artist in British Columbia named Bill Reed, and he makes beautiful jewelry in that and other pieces. He's deceased now, but there's this quote about that a legacy a man leaves behind is how the work of his hands and how well made the work of his hands are. And that's what we always think about you, is that how the care that you have, whether it's for a structural piece or for the artistic, it's something that you put your care and love in, and that we enjoy it as your customer and as your friend, the beautiful work of your hands and your head that make and your ability to work in this form, this media. And so we're appreciative because it's something that we not only enjoy, but other people will get to enjoy. So that's why we wanted this little brief picture into your story.
Well, Brenda, you coming from a metal family, your father being a bridge builder, knew what craftsmanship was. And mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why metal work is so much more appreciated in Europe than here is because the people actually know what they're looking at.
Yeah.
You know, most people think that, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, the metal gets soft and it pushes around like putty and you don't have to heat it up to 2,000 degrees to make it move, right? So that's a blessing, and it's been a privilege to know you and have you appreciate my ironwork, that's for sure.
Well, as a craftsman and artist, we're grateful that our paths have crossed and we enjoyed this time. Thanks.